The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Dreamers, Winners, and Making a Difference with Michael Friedlander. Michael is an international business lawyer and consultant who has also been the CEO of three international companies. Michael has also written three books, one of which is about how Nelson Mandela realized his own dreams to become an iconic winner who saved a nation. In today's show, join Michael in a conversation with his guest, a winner who has also made a difference for the better in the lives of those he or she has touched. Michael and his guest will offer some insight that might well help you realize your own dreams. Now, here is your host, Michael Friedlander.
Well, I am Michael Friedlander, and welcome to the show. I'm truly delighted to have with us today Arash Asher, who is the Director of Cancer Survivorship and Rehabilitation at the Samuel Oshin Comprehensive Cancer Institute at Cedars-Sinai. Asher, did I pronounce that correctly?
You got it great. Thank you, Michael.
I'm going to let you talk about what you do, Arash, but I will say that you graduated summa cum laude from Claremont McKenna College with a Bachelor of Arts degree in neuroscience. You received a medical degree from the University of Rochester School of Medicine, and that you've received several honors and awards, including an award of excellence from the Southern California Cancer Pain Initiative. And I believe you're a member of the Phi Beta Kappa sect, cult, fraternity, whatever they call it. Anyway, the name of the show today is called That Crisis Thing, Facing It With Dignity. What I'm hoping to explore with you today, Asher, is what we can learn from the cancer community in dealing with crisis in our everyday life. I have to say that I'm in awe of the grace and dignity with which so many cancer patients deal with their crises. And there are two specific reasons that I'm really quite interested in this subject. Firstly, I think I may have mentioned to you that many, many years ago, I had a friend who was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I was absolutely astounded by the grace and dignity with which he faced the last years of his life. And then by some strange, ironic twist, a couple of years ago, I was diagnosed with the same strain of cancer that he had, but luckily for me, they caught it quite early, and I've now enjoying a full recovery. That said, let's begin by asking you, hey, just what do you do, Asher?
Michael, if I could first say I'm honored to have this conversation with you, particularly because, you know, I wasn't trained in medical school or residency or fellowship to talk about all the important things that you are striving to talk about, these things about, you know, going through this with grace and dignity and finding meaning and resiliency in life through something as difficult as cancer. You know, my own background is one where I went to medical school, and, you know, originally I thought I wanted to be an oncologist, and I realized that I wasn't so interested necessarily in prescribing chemo, which is basically, in most cases, a poison, or radiating people or treating people with surgery. I was really interested to see how we can help put someone's life back together after going through all the toxicities of something so intensive like cancer, because it doesn't affect you just on a physical level, but as you hinted at, it, you know, affects you emotionally, affects you psychologically. It really affects your entire spirit and soul. So I found my way to rehabilitation medicine. And when I was there, you know, traditionally, rehab folks take care of people who went through traumatic events like, you know, a spinal cord injury like Christopher Reeves, let's say, or a traumatic brain injury or an amputation. There wasn't really much in the way of cancer rehabilitation because historically it was kind of an oxymoron. You know, if you had cancer, the goal was just survival. There wasn't anything about historically about, you know, surviving well or rehabilitating from it. But the good news is today in 2014, we have about 14 million cancer survivors in the United States alone. And I think with that comes the need from us as a culture to help our patients thrive. And I think out of that need was born this little niche area of cancer rehabilitation, which is what I've been working on day in and day out here at Cedars-Sinai.
When did you first want to become a doctor?
I don't know. When I was 7 years old, I had a ruptured appendix. And I'll never forget that when I was being shuffled down to the operating room, there was an anesthesiologist who looked me in the eye, and she was perfectly calm and collected. She held my head. She told me everything was going to be okay. She guided me through what was going to happen. And she was very, very gentle, and you could tell she was very, very caring. And that was the last memory I had before I went in for the surgery. And it's really the memory that stuck with me the most during that entire experience, because I learned at a very young age how powerful communication and caring can be in part of medical care. And I think that stuck with me for a long, long time.
Ah, that's very cool. Arush, could you talk a little about the book that you read when you were 17? The book written by Viktor Frankl, who was also a Holocaust survivor and Austrian neurologist and psychiatrist.
Before medical school, before college, I read a book that I think influenced me on a very, very profound level. It was probably one of the reasons why I wanted to go into medicine in the first place. The name of a book, it's a classic, is Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. I think it's a book that every human being should read at some point, because I think it's impossible to go through this world without experiencing suffering at some point on some level, even if you don't go through something difficult like cancer. In his case, you know, Viktor Frankl was a young psychiatrist, I believe in his 20s, when he was living in Austria, and it was in the 1940s, and he ended up in a concentration camp, actually several concentration camps. And during those 2 or 3 years, he lost his pregnant wife, he lost his parents, he lost his siblings. I mean, he lost virtually everyone that was close to him. He went through, and I'm not going to recount all the horrors of the Holocaust, but you could imagine, every kind of physical type of torture. He went through starvation, physical illness, et cetera, et cetera. And he wrote this book as he emerged from the Holocaust. And I think it was a testament to the human spirit, because he came up with this idea that if you find meaning in your suffering, and obviously he suffered a lot those years, you can get through anything. And for him, telling his story and as a psychiatrist writing about this philosophy, which we refer to as logotherapy, which is the therapy about finding meaning in your suffering, he thought if you can find meaning in what you're going through, you can get through anything. And he, I think, obviously is quite qualified to tell that story because of the profound loss and suffering that he went through. And he really has been a great source of hope for many people, including in my own practice, people who have lost on some level so much from a cancer diagnosis.
I was really interested to read, Asha, that you said that the greatest lesson you took from Frankl's memoir was that nobody can take away the last of the human freedoms, which is one's ability to choose his or her attitude in any given set of circumstances. And I found that really quite profound, because we all do have the ability to change our attitude and to act reasonably and generously and with dignity. And I'm really always sort of quite astounded why people don't do that more often.
You control your attitude, and like he said, it's the last human freedom. It's something, and when you go through something like cancer, let's say, and again, I'm just using cancer as an example because it's kind of what I see on a day-to-day basis. But if you look at someone who's going through intensive chemo and intensive radiation requiring one or more surgeries, clinical trials, et cetera, et cetera, these are all things that are being passively given to you. In other words, the patient has no control on the type of chemo or what kind of radiation or where, when the surgery is going to be. You know, they really have limited control over these things, which is, I think, hard when, you know, you're an adult managing your own life and making your own decisions to be, have that kind of vulnerability. But when we have and we can do this again with our friends and family members, when we have an opportunity to remind them that you still have control over the most important thing, which is how you're going to respond to what is coming your way, I think that can be very, very powerful. I really think you bring up the idea that when somebody goes through something like, let's say, cancer, I think it really brings our values, it sharpens our values, and it reminds us of what's more important. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've had a patient tell me, you know, on one hand, you know, cancer sucks. Nobody wants a cancer diagnosis. We would never wish this on anyone. But at the same time, without wanting to look through this through, rose-colored glasses, you'll find people tell you that even though they're going through all this and they would have never wished this upon themselves or anyone else, they've found that what's most important to them has become much better crystallized. They're much more clear on what's most important in life, which invariably, you know, I never hear anything about, you know, money or power, but it's about the ability to cherish the moment, to laugh, to spend time with their loved ones, to live a life that really is meaningful for them. And oftentimes, in some strange twist of fate, and sometimes people have a sense of gratitude because they're able to, again, become much more clear on what's most important, on living a good life for themselves.
Well, Asha, I can say that from my own experience, I found the emotional side much more difficult to bear than the physical side. And I kept remembering what my friend had told me, the friend that had died from the same type of cancer that I had. He said to me that you really have only two choices. The first choice is to resign yourself to the fact that you're going to die and just sit and wait with your family and loved ones until that happens. Or you can decide to make the best of whatever time you have left and really live your life to the fullest. And he said there really wasn't a choice.
You know, I'm honored to be here because on a day-to-day basis, actually, you know, my training was actually on, you know, helping people with nausea and physical pain and difficulty sleeping and fatigue and rehabilitation and weakness. But after, you know, being in this arena for a period of time, you quickly learn that if you just managed the pain, you know, you give the opioid of your choice and manage the pain, but didn't address all the other aspects that I think are involved in holistic integrated care, then I really wasn't doing a great service for our patients. So I think a lot of this came through what I learned from our patients, from people like you, and hearing what's really most important, or really listening to them.
You know, what really struck me, Asha, as I think back on my experiences during my cancer, is how useful the lessons that I was learning were outside the world of cancer, and how great it would be for people who hadn't experienced cancer to experience those same lessons, but without having to endure the cancer. And particularly for people who wanted to realize their dreams and realize their potential, those lessons, I think, are absolutely invaluable. And just one final thought. It always struck me that if the people who face cancer and who have every right to be upset and disappointed and angry are gracious and dignified, why on earth can't those without cancer act the same way?
I think the lessons are universal. I think one of the things that saddens me sometimes is when I hear some of our patients tell us that, you know, they had their group of, let's say, friends or family members, and you'll always hear that there'll be a subset, sometimes a large subset, that will stop visiting or stop calling because they don't want to have anything to do with them now that they have, you know, stage four colon cancer or whatever it may be. And I think it's a huge loss, because I think on one hand, certainly that patient who's going through all this, I think, needs their friends now more than ever. But as you had suggested, they have a lot to teach to their friends and family members as well. And I think it's a loss for our whole community when this this segment of the population is shunned away that way.
Well, people don't like dealing with unpleasantness, and they don't like having to confront mortality, I think.
Exactly.
And I think those people who refuse to visit cancer patients are themselves far more the victims than the cancer patients to some extent. And it's a real shame. You know, it's a real shame. I think I shared with you one of the lessons that my friend passed on to me before he died, which was he said that in his mind, the greatest obstacle to overcome in facing cancer or any difficulty, and I don't want this just to be about cancer because I think it applies equally to the non-cancer
sure.
world.
Of course.
Is he said that being sorry for yourself, self-pity, is a self-indulgence that we can't afford. And what we have to do, he said his greatest challenge was firstly not to feel sorry for himself and to get those around him, his friends and his family, not to feel sorry for him. And he said that was far more difficult than not feeling sorry for himself because his friends and family were devastated. And the problem was that if they felt sorry for him, then he would start feeling sorry for himself and he would embark on a downward spiral that was very difficult to stop. And I think that the support that people around a cancer patient or around anybody who faces a crisis is really critical. And I think that we can all avoid feeling sorry for ourselves in every form of life that we happen to be indulging in. It's really important, in my mind anyway.
And you know, one of the things I've seen people use as an antidote to that is, and I'm really, I'm in so much admiration for people that have this uncanny ability is really the ability to laugh, regardless of what their situation is. And I think from our previous conversations, that was one of your great strengths as well. Am I right?
Well, you know, I'm weird. You know, I've just got a shot. I've got a strange sense of humor. And, you know, I'll just tell you one illustration of how strange I am. So I'm about to have my first chemo session. And I'm parked in this lounge chair. But anyway, they gave me something to put me to sleep a little bit. And when I awoke, I found my nurse about to administer the actual chemo. And she came in wearing a green protective apron, booties, gloves, goggles, the whole shebang. And I said to her, "Where are you going, all dressed up?" And she said to me, well, she was about to administer the chemo, and she had to be very careful that it didn't spill and get on her because it was really quite toxic. So I said, "Okay." Let me make sure if I have this right. So you're worried about this chemo spilling on you. This is the same chemo that you're about to pump into me intravenously. Have I got this right? And although I have to admit it was kind of terrifying, I had to laugh because the ridiculousness of that whole situation just was profound for me.
I'm glad, you know, you're able to laugh. You know, some people, they let their, as you mentioned, the self-pity or anxiety get to them so much that they're unable to kind of take these little moments and try to lighten up as you did. But it's a great skill. And if we don't have a natural sense of humor ourselves, it helps to have friends or someone like you to kind of come along and lighten someone's mood. You know, you're living proof of the idea that it's possible to find humor in difficult circumstances, and patients I see every day are living proof of that. So I completely agree. There, you know, it would be hard to go through all these things, the pain and the nausea, and have some sense of resilience if you didn't find humor in those things that can kind of lighten the mood.
Asha, all I can say is that a lot of the times the things I found funny were funny in retrospect and not at the time. But that's it. I think that we are almost out of this segment, so don't anybody go away. We'll be back soon, and we will deal with a bunch of things in the next segment that we just didn't have time for now.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
Want to help make our world a better place, but not sure where to start? Tune into Better Worldians Radio,
with the creators of the social game on Facebook called A Better World. Join hosts Ray, Mary Sue, and Gregory Hansel, who will inspire you to make a big difference in small ways. They'll speak to experts, authors, volunteers, and everyday people who are changing the world daily. Better Worldians Radio is heard live every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time, on Voice America Variety.
Tired of lackluster results with your marketing? Craving more leads in your business? Tune in to the Mojo Marketing Edge with the team behind Mojo Global Marketing, Ira Rosen and Corey Michael Sanchez. Winners of the Marketer of the Year, they will show you how to generate daily leads, build databases of raving fans, and close deals faster than ever before. See what's hot right now and how you can tap into it to generate an endless supply of customers and clients. The Mojo Marketing Edge can be heard every Monday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. There are over 140 million products manufactured worldwide. It is impossible to know the ingredients in these products, especially those made overseas. Stan Salat, creator of the HSF Mark and the Counterfeit Mark Alliance, is the host of People to People, working together for your safety. Stan believes in our right to know the type and amount of hazardous materials in consumer products and whether they are counterfeit. Find out how you can protect yourself every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Variety.
Follow us on Twitter at Voice America TRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's Voice America TRN.
You are listening to Dreamers, Winners, and Making a Difference with Michael Friedlander. To find out more about our program, please visit www.dreamersandwinners.com. Now, back to this week's program.
Well, welcome back to the second segment. I still have with me Dr. Arash Asher. And I'd like to begin by talking about the two Chinese characters that make up the word crisis. The first is danger, and the second is opportunity. And it seems to me that what you've managed to do, Arash, is you've managed to embrace the opportunity with the danger, which I think is fascinating.
What do you mean by danger in this context?
Well, whenever anybody faces a crisis, they are facing danger. You know, in my own case, when I heard that I had cancer, I thought I was going to die. That was, for me, dangerous.
But, you know, and that's true. And in all seriousness, one of the privileges of this kind of work is when you're in this moment of danger, that is an open door to create some kind of change, whether it's for the better or for the worse. Because you catch people at a point where they are open, when because their senses are heightened, and we really, I think, try to take advantage of that to instill all the things that you've been talking about today.
But in the world of business, you know, when a business is faced with crisis, they see a danger, they see a looming disaster often, and in focusing just on avoiding the danger, they tend to be one-dimensional often. And they don't follow this through with the second part of the word, which is opportunity.
Exactly.
You know, and I think this is a great opportunity that we're talking about right now, because what you do is something, and you do it just instinctively, is something that I don't think the rest of us do instinctively. When something bad happens, all we want to do is stem the bleeding and fix it. And I'm not sure that we all often take the second step, which is to see, well, what opportunity arises out of what we're now facing.
In oncology, they refer to this moment as the teachable moment, because we know that this is when you have an opportunity to create some kind of behavior change for the better.
Arash, you mentioned to me that there was another book that was a great source of inspiration to you. You want to talk about that?
You know, I've had some great sources of inspiration along the way. There's another author that has meant a lot to me over the years. There is a physician by the name of Rachel Naomi Remen who wrote a fabulous book. You may have heard of it, My Grandfather's Blessings. And she was actually a pediatrician, I believe, who had had her own chronic illness. And because of what she went through personally, she really transformed her career to one where she has been helping people with cancer and other chronic illnesses find meaning again in what they're going through and deal with the non-physical aspects of a chronic illness. And one of the points that I think she, on some level, has articulated so well is this idea of differentiating between helping someone and being of service to someone. And if you think about it, when you help someone, when I'm helping somebody, I imagine, for example, somebody is down on the ground, I reach out my arm and I lift them up. So I am helping them. So I am giving to them and they are really giving nothing in return to me. And when somebody, I think, has that kind of attitude in life in general, it's always a one-way relationship. And it's a relationship between unequals. As opposed to being of service to someone, when you view our daily deeds in terms of service, it's a relationship between equals. It's a way of, yes, I'm helping you up, but in some way, you are teaching me something, you are allowing me to participate in your health, and so it's mutually rewarding. And I think in medicine, when, and I'll take my own field, when we physicians view our day-to-day role as just helping people, I think that leads to burning out, and that leads to being dogmatic, and that leads to this idea of do it my way, or otherwise you could find yourself another physician. But I think when we as a medical community view our work as that of service, I think number one, the outcomes are probably better because you don't feel, like you mentioned earlier, you don't feel like you're being pitied in some way or someone is doing something to you, but rather you're kind of working as a team to improve your health in the best way possible.
That's a wonderful concept. I mean, until we spoke, that had never occurred to me. But I think that in life generally, you know, I think that this there is a real difference between helping and service. And what you've just articulated, I think, is amazing. I mean, it really is totally amazing.
I think the other ideas that are worth differentiating, and this happens again for us physicians all the time, is, and Dr. Remen has some great stories that illustrate this idea well, is this idea between thinking about curing someone versus healing someone. And, you know, traditionally in medicine, our entire focus is on cure. And as you know, there are some situations that there is no possibility for cure. But I deeply believe, and I wouldn't be here talking to you if I didn't believe this, that even though cure may be a possibility only for some, that everyone has the capacity to heal. And sometimes, you know, the healing can be highly individual. And I think what really can help with the healing, regardless of what we may be going through medically, is something we began to talk about, is this idea of finding meaning and finding, in some sense, our legacy, which is something I think in our society we don't think about or talk about at all.
When you say healing, though, what do you mean?
That's a good question. So what do we mean by healing? So to me, healing means feeling at peace. It means being able to appreciate any given moment. It means having some sense of gratitude, whatever it may be. I think traditionally, you know, the medical world has come to define healing as being in remission or having an antibiotic that gets rid of a bacteria. But I think if you look at illness and healing in ancient times, the idea of healing was not having a loss of direction, not having a loss of purpose, still having a sense of awe. It invoked ideas about the soul much more than it does today with our current medical model.
You know, what just totally fascinates me is how this applies in the world of law and in the world of business. Because in the world of business, they are the problem solvers, and you have to have those who can solve problems. But the way you've defined healing is really the corporate culture that you have to have in place to allow for problems to be solved. Isn't that right?
Yeah, and you would, I believe you would know that whole world better than I, but I imagine so.
And, you know, this whole concept of helping versus service. I mean, helping, and I have to tell you that this never occurred to me before we had our conversations. I mean, helping is kind of condescending, isn't it?
It is kind of condescending. Especially, I think oftentimes the person who is helping kind of pats themselves on the back for, you know, I did a great job. And, you know, and you kind of soothe your own ego. Whereas, you know, I think service is much more satisfying on a deeper level. And I think, particularly from the medical end, I think we'd be much less likely to burn out if that attitude was the attitude we came in with.
Yeah, but you know, the other point is that if you want to be helped, you have to approach it in a mindset in which you are participating.
Exactly.
And you know, I just think back to the corporate world that I've come from and to lawyers and whatever else. And I just think this whole idea of having direction and having a balance and knowing where you are and knowing where you're going and not losing direction is absolutely critical in the world of business. Or if you're looking to realize your dreams, which this program is all about, or to achieve your potential, you have to know where you're going. And, you know, one of my favorite stories in Alice in Wonderland, and I've repeated this many times, and anyone who's heard me speak before, I apologize. There's this great story. Alice is lost and she comes to a fork in the road. And there's the Cheshire Cat sitting in a tree at the fork. And she says to the Cheshire Cat, you know, I'm lost. Which fork should I take? And the Cheshire Cat looks down at her and says, well, where are you going? And she says, I don't know. And then the cat says, well, it doesn't matter. Take any fork you like. And it's I think it's a wonderful, wonderful story, because unless you know where you're going, you know, you'll never get there.
And I think it's interesting to think about how when you really focus on healing as opposed to curing, you know, you really in some ways learn to not live your life differently. And because I don't think finding meaning in healing requires you to live differently, but it requires you to see your life differently. And I think this gets back to the idea of Viktor Frankl's quote of the last of the human freedoms that can never be taken away, because just seeing our lives differently and having that change in perspective and attitude can allow you to go beyond the superficial to things that are more essential, that are much more heartfelt.
But doesn't this all boil down to exactly the same thing, which is that you have the power to control your attitude, and it's your attitude that really will determine how successful you're going to be? And I think that, you know, too many people are self-indulgent and they allow themselves to be mean-spirited and inconsiderate. And I've never, ever seen, and I'm sure there are cancer patients and their families who are quite awful, but I've never seen anybody behave in a way that I've seen other people behave, that are unpleasant and mean-spirited. I just don't see that.
After cancer?
And during.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that people sometimes who felt themselves to be victims in life, sometimes when they have a life-transforming event, like, let's say, going through a cancer diagnosis, really surprise themselves and see how much strength they have and realize that in many ways, they've been a hero in their own right because of how they were able to overcome what they were able to overcome and kind of go into that inner strength that was untapped until this point. I think the challenge is, and I think this is the point of this whole conversation on some level, is how do you tap into these ideas of resiliency and strength without necessarily having to go through a cancer diagnosis? How do you teach that to someone?
What's the answer, doctor?
I was going to ask you first. You've been through it.
You know what? My feeling is that you have to start out with balance. You know, one of the great lessons that I learned from my experience is you have to really understand what's important and what isn't, and who's important and who isn't. And the one lesson I came out of the cancer with was that you can't afford to spend a lot of time dealing with what's not important and with who's not important. You just have to have a sense of focus, and you have to have a balance. And I think that too often, people don't have that balance. And they worry about stuff they shouldn't be worrying about, and they get upset by stuff they shouldn't be getting upset about.
But this is, I think, still the greatest challenge. You know, I have a 2.5-year-old and an 8-month-old right now. And one of the things my wife and I often talk about is how do we instill, and I should take a step back. My wife and I are both immigrants. We both came to this country at the age of 2 or 3. And so, you know, we kind of had to learn how to create our paths without it being necessarily handed it to us. But how do you pass along those values and all the values that you're talking about today to someone without necessarily making them suffer? How do you teach someone the values that a cancer survivor has learned without making them go through a cancer experience?
That's a good question. I don't have a clue. I will tell you that when I wrote my book on Nelson Mandela, he said that he believed that it's nurture rather than nature that results in the development of character. And for example, his father made a great point of impressing upon Mandela that you have to put the interests of those you represent ahead of your personal interests. You can't put yourself first. You have to put those who you represent ahead of you. And I think that that was impressed on him at a very, very early age. Now, he was living in a mud hut with no electricity, you know, none of the modern conveniences, certainly. But that followed him throughout his life. And I think that the same thing will happen with your kids. And their values, you know, I think it's all about values. And, you know, I also think that the process by which you communicate those values is really, really important. And I think that this wonderful differentiation you've made between helping and service must play quite a large role there, because if you tell kids something, they'll never treat it in quite the same way as if it's a voyage of discovery that you're taking them on, and they reach that conclusion that you would have wanted to tell them anyway.
And I think one of the things you're hinting at, which I know we've talked about briefly before, is this idea of legacy and this idea of how do we pass along these values, whether it's to our children, our family members, our community, without necessarily having to make them suffer the same way that...
Let's do this. Let's keep that for the next segment.
We don't really have enough time to get into it in the 30 seconds or so that's left. But I will just repeat one story that I've told before and that I'm sure I'll tell again, and that's the story of how I once accidentally heard Bill Clinton give an interview about one of his latest books. And what he said and what caught my attention was him saying, just imagine if your grandparents had written down their life lessons and had passed them on to you. What greater gift could they ever have given you? And ain't that the truth? And isn't that really that same legacy question? Anyway, stay tuned.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Voice America presents a new kind of health awareness talk show, the Sharon Kleina Hour, Health, Environment, and the Power of Water. Show host Sharon Kleina interviews leading scientists to discover how each of us can become proactive in protecting our personal health environment in an increasingly unhealthy world. Every show offers new information that could save your life. The Sharon Kleina Hour is health from an environmental perspective, your ultimate source for a personal environmental lifestyle. Listen Mondays at 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel and Wednesdays at 12 noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Families today face unique challenges. Marriage, parenting, and family forms have changed a lot in the last century. Family Matters with Dr. Virginia Collin will focus on building and maintaining healthy family relationships. We will discuss marriage, divorce, family mediation, parenting, lifestyles, and mental health, all kinds of family matters. Our show will feature guest experts and your participation, too. You can listen to Family Matters live every Tuesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific on Voice America Variety.
It's time to take a new look at some of life's changing moments. It's time to listen to an expert who has been there and can provide insight through experience, studies, and enlightening guests. Tune in to Illuminating Now, Lindsay's Life Secrets. Host Lindsay Levinson takes a look at relationships, parenting, health and wellness, divorce, depression, sexuality, philanthropy, and mental health. You'll look at everything you know in a different way. Illuminating Now, Lindsay's Life Secrets, airs Wednesdays at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Variety.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
You are listening to Dreamers, Winners, and Making a Difference with Michael Friedlander. To find out more about our program, please visit www.dreamersandwinners.com. Now, back to this week's program.
Well, welcome back to the third segment of That Crisis Thing, Facing It With Dignity. And Arash, why don't we continue where we left off the last segment, talking about legacy and how we pass along stuff.
How do we pass along these values, whether it's to our children, our family members, our community? And it brings to mind something I actually learned from the ecology world, which is this question. So where do you think it's best to plant a young tree? And the question is, would it be best to plant a young tree in a forest clearing or an old growth forest? So would it be better in an open field or an old growth forest? Any ideas?
That's a minefield I don't intend entering into.
Okay, I'll tell you the answer. So the answer is, you know, I actually first thought an open clearing would be best because you could, you know, you could take all the nutrients for yourself. You don't have any competition from any of the older trees. But apparently, ecologists will tell you that a young tree will grow better when it's planted in an area with older trees. And there's a number of reasons they give for that. They'll say that when the roots of a young tree are able to follow the pathways created by former trees, that the roots will be able to graft themselves to each other better, that the stronger trees share resources with weaker ones, and they actually are interdependent upon each other in that foundation that is deep underground. And I think the analogy is that we have a lot to gain and learn from people that have gone through life in ways that we haven't, from our grandparents, from, you know, our community members. I think the challenge is that we, you know, there are more and more people who live isolated and very lonely lives. And I think it's hard for the tribe to learn from each other when the tribe really doesn't exist as much as it used to.
You know, this is so interesting because one of the themes of this program is the African concept of Ubuntu, which is about our interconnectedness. It's about how we do better when we work together and we can help one another.
Incidentally, I'm going to have trouble using the word help forever in the future. And for that, I'm going to blame you.
You can blame it on me, yeah.
I shall, don't worry about that. But the point is that by working together, we can accomplish much. And I just believe that the sooner that people really, not come to terms with, but really recognize this concept of Ubuntu, it's going to be a whole lot better for them, a whole lot easier for them, and the results will be much, much better. But your example of the tree is really fascinating because it's common wisdom, I suppose, that if you're first to market in the business world, you have this huge advantage. And I've always maintained that that ain't necessarily so because it's very tough for people to invest money in a project that's brand new in an area that's never been traveled before, and you're actually better off many times being second to market and being able to make the argument that you're going to do better than the guy that was first to market. But practically, what you're really saying is that if you're going to plant the tree, plant it somewhere where it's been successfully grown before. Isn't it the same thing we're talking about?
Exactly, and I think it's a great analogy for the idea of legacy as well, because we need each other, I think. You know, the reality is we live in a Wild West kind of mentality in our culture where a great value was to have this idea that you do it all on your own. You never need anyone's support. You're completely independent. You're living in the ranch in the Wild West. And I think that's not how we've lived our lives, you know, historically for, you know, thousands and thousands of years up to this point. That, you know, historically, there's always been an interconnection between people and different generations. And there was always this idea that those who have come before us have a responsibility to pass on some of these values and pearls of wisdom to those that come later.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more, Arash. You know, I've spoken before about how I remember Bill Clinton saying how great it would be if your grandparents had written down their life lessons for you. What a greater gift could they possibly have given you? And this is really exactly what you're saying. And I also think that so often we take for granted the lessons of those that came before us. We seem to think that this new technology that we have makes us so much better than those that preceded us. Better, perhaps, in some ways, but certainly wiser, I'm not so sure about. The guest on our last show, Steve Burrows, who's a world-acclaimed engineer, has made a study of looking at how the ancient engineers built the great iconic structures. And he makes a point of saying how much we can learn from them. That's exactly what you're saying, isn't it? I mean,
that's exactly it. Yeah. I mean, you know, I didn't realize Bill Clinton said that, but I want to expand upon that. Not only would it be helpful.
Incidentally, you can find almost anything that Bill Clinton has said. He said it all.
But, you know, I really like that idea. But, you know, in addition to how great it would be if my grandparents had written down their pearls of wisdom and their life lessons for me, how, you know, it would be certainly very, very valuable for me. But one of the things I've learned with taking care of people with, let's say, metastatic cancer is writing those values down with intention of, let's say, giving it to our children or our grandchildren is not only imperative for them, but oftentimes what it actually does is it allows the person who's writing it down to remind themselves the kind of world that they want to live in, and it allows them to try to live that life as best as they can right now. So it's really reminding you of what's most important, because you're thinking about these things. You're not just thinking about, you know, just taking out the trash the next day and the bills that you got to pay. You're really thinking about, again, what's most meaningful and what is most important. And, you know, that's the whole idea of legacy. It's not about death, but it's about reminding us what's most important to us.
Asha, I couldn't agree more with you about the value in writing some of this stuff down. I think I told you that after I was diagnosed with cancer, and particularly when it was the strain of cancer that my friend had died from, I was in a state of, let me say, panic might be too generous a term. But anyway, a friend of mine made an absolutely terrific suggestion to me. He was a doctor. He said that I should consider writing a diary. He'd read my previous book, and he liked the way I wrote, and he thought that it could even be helpful, not just for me, but for other people with cancer and their families. Anyway, because I'm just weird, I decided to write it only because the idea of writing something where I didn't know the ending kind of perversely appealed to me. But I'm ashamed to admit that I decided to do it not for any altruistic reasons. I did it solely for myself. And what I discovered was that it was truly therapeutic. It was absolutely a mind-boggling experience. What happened was that at the beginning of my chemo, I was told that I'd feel crappy for maybe 4 or 5 days, and for the next 8 or 9 days, I had chemo every 2 weeks, my body would be recovering in time for the next session. Well, they got a little wrong. I felt crappy for about 12 days, and then the 2 days before the chemo, I felt fine, and it was then that I wrote my diary entry for the previous 2 weeks. And it was really, really useful, looking back and saying to myself, well, what the hell has just happened here? And forgetting the legacy issue for a moment, assuming anybody would be interested in what I went through, for me personally, it was an amazing, amazing experience, and I would highly recommend it to anyone. So I can say you're absolutely right about the value in writing stuff down.
It really gives you, a tremendous sense of perspective on what was most important for you, I imagine.
Well, you know, one of the things is that people think that anybody who goes through cancer only thinks about cancer, which is not true.
You know, you have this intense sense of introspection, and you think about your life, and you think about life lessons. And those are worth capturing. You know, they really are worth capturing.
If I could make a comment, you know, we've been talking during the last hour about this idea of attitude and dignity and meaning and legacy. I don't want to misconstrue the point that I think you have to be positive all the time. So if you're someone sitting out there who has cancer, I don't think it means that one can or needs to be positive every single moment. And I've actually heard some ridiculous things out there that if you ever allow yourself to be sad or angry or upset, that somehow you're going to make the cancer grow faster, or you're going to be, you know, changing the environment around the cancer cells. I mean, I think that's just garbage. And there's this idea that sometimes if you over-obsess with this idea of having to be living a certain emotion, like being happy every single moment, otherwise you're going to let the cancer grow, is really tyrannical more than anything else. So I hope we're not sending that message.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that the only thing you have to be really careful about is not descending into the self-pity pit. So, you know, you have to look, you have to, when you're feeling crappy, you're feeling crappy. And there's no way you're going to,
exactly.
There's no way you're going to feel happy about that. But when I'm talking about being positive, all I'm talking about is not feeling sorry for yourself. I mean, you can feel like crap, but don't focus on yourself. I mean, this is just one of the byproducts of what you're going through.
Another thought about this positivity thing. Just as it's just unrealistic to be positive the whole time, you're absolutely right. You know, when you're feeling bad, you're feeling bad. But the one thing that I do remember is that if anything was likely to make me feel suicidal, it was to have a lot of people around me cheerleading me on, encouraging me to be positive all the time. I couldn't handle that. And in fact, I reveled in my solitude quite often. It was very important to be alone and to be quiet. And I was really lucky that the people around me respected this and understood it. But let's move on. I'd now like to talk about some of these lessons as they apply to the non-cancer world.
This issue of legacy creation,
for example.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit in terms, not of cancer, but just life experience?
Sure. I think legacy creation is something that anyone can think about, and I hope that we're making the argument that we all should be thinking about it sometimes. Because again, it's not about death. It's about reminding us of what's most important to us. I think legacy really helps us decide the kind of life we want to live. Because when you think about what you want to be known for, whenever it may be your time, you're going to want to think about things like, I was known for being the guy who, you know, made people laugh, or the person that was of service to his community, or the person that was passionate about education. And when you think about those things that are most important for you, what happens is, rather than waiting till the end of your life until you think about them, when you think about them today, then you're going to be acting upon those principles. And I think, I know this sounds cheesy, but I think it's true, that then we all start acting upon those principles because we know where we want to go, and we're helping to create the kind of world that we ultimately want to live in.
Well, you know, one of the premises of the show is that a winner is someone who's realized his or her dreams by acting ethically and without cheating, but who's made a difference for the better in the lives of those they touch. And it seems to me that that should be a driving principle in everything we do. Everything we do should either be something that'll touch someone for the better, or at least won't make anything worse. And I just wonder if enough people really do that.
It's hard when we're kind of living day by day. You know, I feel some ways blessed because I'm reminded of this every day. You know, you went through your experience, so you had a very personal reminder of these things. But I could imagine when you're just going day by day and, you know, dealing with all the stressors of kind of modern life, it's sometimes hard to take a step back and think about what's most important and what you're doing this all for.
Yeah, I think it is hard. But I will say that after my cancer experience and after focusing in on this program, I look at pretty much everything that I do now in the context of saying, is what I'm doing going to make a difference in anyone's lives? Or if it's not going to make a difference for the better, is it going to adversely impact anyone?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that when you're rude to somebody or you're unpleasant to somebody or you're mean-spirited to somebody, then you're taking a step back. And I don't think there's ever an excuse for that. You know, I was invited to be on a jury, and they declined my services. The case was a domestic violence case. And when the judge asked if any of us had strong feelings about this, I said, I couldn't think of a single instance that justified domestic violence of any kind. I wasn't brought up that anybody could strike anyone in anger or for any other reason. It's just the way I was brought up. And that I couldn't be a rational, reasonable juror looking at somebody who admittedly engaged in domestic violence. I just can't. And I think that it's just a frame of thought that either you have or you don't have. And I'm not saying I'm right and everybody else is wrong, but I'm just saying is that if you look at your life, I believe, in terms of are you making a difference for the better or not, it is a guiding light.
You know, I deeply believe that, you know, each time you, Michael, are communicating these messages, that you just never know how it impacts one person, and the way that person starts living may impact another and another and another. And I really do believe that what you're saying is contagious that way.
Well, you know, the other point is that they may just laugh at me, in which case
You succeeded either way. I was going to say, this was a great privilege for me, Michael, and I think you're doing a great deed with this whole program, and I wish you great success with this.
Well, Arash, thank you so much. I can't begin to tell you how much I've enjoyed meeting you and speaking with you and learning from you, and I really hope we'll be able to do it again. As for our guest next week, stay tuned. I don't have a clue who that'll be, so stay tuned. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to Dreamers, Winners, and Making a Difference with Michael Friedlander. Please join us again next Monday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Until then, Michael encourages you to keep daring to dream and to remember what Nelson Mandela once wrote, namely that a winner is a dreamer who never gives up.